Hello, this week's Brewing Podcast with me, Guy Foster, speaking to Simon Brazier, manager of the 91 UK Alpha Fund, is not intended as investment advice. Simon talks about some of his stocks that have weathered the COVID crisis well and some new opportunities he's found while prices have been weak, but bear in mind that we can't guarantee sources from outside Brewing Dolphin. Tax legislation and allowances can change, and we may hold some of the securities mentioned. He talks about how the retail world has been affected by COVID, which retailers have resilient delivery services, and complains that
I think we're still in the first half of the match. We haven't had our oranges yet at half time.
To find out why, keep listening, but remember, when investing your capital is at risk, investment values may increase or decrease as a result of currency fluctuations, and future performance may differ from that of the past. Well, hello everybody. Welcome to the latest Brewing Podcast. Pleased on this occasion to be joined by Simon Brazier, who is the head of UK funds at 91 and the manager of the 91, formerly Investec, UK Alpha Fund. Simon, welcome back to the podcast.
Afternoon. Sorry not to see you in person, but good to be on it.
Thank you. Right. Well, let's start off. And I think if we were to refer back to one of our previous podcasts, we had Terry Smith on. I'm not sure if you've heard of him, but one of the things that he said, one of the more provocative things I think that he said on the podcast, was that when thinking about the coronavirus, he's not really trying to think about what it's going to do to his companies because it's just so uncertain. And so in fact he was prepared to imagine that the couple of stocks that really affected within his portfolio could be completely wiped out and it wouldn't do too much to his fund. That's probably a luxury that isn't afforded to all fund managers. So I wondered how you're thinking about some of your holdings that may be more affected than others.
Yeah, no, I can see where he's coming from, to be fair. Which is that we were lucky that we came into the crisis in a pretty positive place. And we, you know, majority of the companies in our portfolio, we'd sold a lot of cyclicality in the previous years. You know, we were 85% FTSE 100. You know, we didn't have any small cap. So we were in some of the more sort of globally diversified cash generative areas of the market. And you know, that served us well. Having said that, our job is to, you know, work out where the companies work on a 3 to 5 year view, and always say buy low and sell high and we'll be fine. But it's buying low and selling high relative to what the company's worth. So what I said to our analysts right at the start of the crisis, this is where I had some sympathy with Terry Smith, is do not spend the next 6 weeks, 2 months, trying to work out what the 2020 earnings and profit number is for these companies, because we have no idea. We don't, you know, this is down to scientists and politicians ultimately, and, you know, how quickly, if any, recovery there will be. What we need to do is check two things. One, solvency, i.e. what is the worst case scenario, or the scenario that means the company has an issue with its balance sheet? And two, what will this company be worth as we come out the other side? So for example, let me give you one example. Next, which is a, you know, obviously everyone knows a clothing retailer, is not a company that we owned as we came into the crisis. But we have a very strong view of what that company could be worth in 2, 3, 4 years' time. And actually, the balance sheet is in a pretty strong place and would see it through a pretty meaningful downturn and closure of stores. But not only that, as it comes out the other side, we actually think from a competitive position, it comes out even stronger than where it went in, because many of its competitors will not exist. And not only that, it's got this amazing online distribution platform, which many of its, even its competitors use the Next platform. So we have been prepared to take on risk in companies. Actually, so we're moving from the point of, we had very limited cyclicality, where we have moved a bit towards taking on that, but it's on the basis that we're very wary of the economic outlook, and you know, the company's valuation has to be pricing in a very severe recession. So we can take that on, and I have, so that's why I have some sympathy, which is that in the short term, don't chase your tail and try to work out what the short term issues are apart from the balance sheet. But longer term, actually, that's always been our job, is to work out what a company's worth.
Okay, well let's think a bit more about some of those companies in just a moment, but I think it's obviously true that you have performed reasonably well through this period. So and you mentioned that you sold a lot of cyclicality previously. So what had driven that, just by way of context?
Two things, but one was much more significant. The first, which was the most, was valuation.
Right.
Literally, for us to own, one of the buckets that we buy called quality cyclicals. But for us, you have to be buying those stocks whether you have valuation protection, because by definition they're cyclical. I wouldn't want to own a house builder through the whole economic cycle, because there'll be points in time where you just won't want to own them. Whereas, to be fair, a Smith and Nephew or a Reckitt Benckiser, I'm happy to own through the cycle because it's not as cyclical a business. So
Yeah.
that was the reason. And actually, I've been showing clients for the last 2 years a page in my presentation called The Bench, and it has about 15, 20 names on it of stocks that I think are great names that I would want to own. But the problem was, I said to them, the only reason I'm not owning these names is because of valuation. So some of the names would be CRH, EasyJet, Fevertree, Hargreaves Lansdown, IHG, Next, Ryanair, all names that we've added to in this crisis, but we're on this page, and I was just literally saying, I can't get valuations to add up. The
Well,
second point I didn't mention was also that I've had a slightly more negative view on the UK economic outlook than most. I mean,
right.
obviously, that's been completely overtaken by COVID-19, but I was saying even before COVID-19, I felt the UK economy could fall 5% in GDP terms this year if certain things happened. So maybe it's been better to be lucky than good, but we were also nervous and we thought the market was too positive on growth generally anyway. But yeah, we certainly didn't predict the pandemic, that's for sure.
Okay, well, look, when you do try and look forward now, I mean, I think it's interesting that one of those companies that Terry Smith is ignoring, I guess, within his portfolio, but one that you're adding to there is IHG. So, how comfortable are you with the outlook for obviously a hotel operator?
Yeah, I mean, you've got to put it in context that the IHG model is not one where they own hotels. I mean, they have a few of them, but 95 plus percent of the hotels are ones where they are either managing on, effectively managing on contract. And so there is for them a slightly more sustainability of the model in terms of the fees that they take on for managing those. And also, don't forget that if you look at China, for example, where earlier, obviously the COVID-19 issue hit earlier, majority of the hotels now are back open in China. And the rumor, if you read the press at the moment, is that hotels will be able to open again pretty soon with obviously stricter guidelines. So, but at the end of the day, we're not trying to second guess what happens in the short term, which is, unless you believe that no one's going to be staying in hotels from next year, and the balance sheet of IHG is in a position such that it can suffer quite a period of effective lockdown, and the valuation which we've been able to buy it at, and also what they've been able to do with their balance sheet in terms of they've managed to waive their covenants for 2 years, a Bank of England commercial loan, I think £600 million. I mean, these are done at some 0.5%. So we actually just take our scenario. We assume that 2019's revenues are not achieved until 2023. So we're not putting a V-shaped recovery in. And we still think that, at the end of the day, post-crisis, if you're booking a hotel, you probably will want to be with a branded hotel where you can be sure of the quality of the, post-COVID-19, the cleaning, what you're getting if you're going to stay in a hotel, and maybe staying in an Airbnb, which has been a bit of a driver. People may be less keen on that because they don't know if it's been sanitized, if it's been cleaned, who was there previously, etc., etc. So from that point of view, it's just all about valuation. And also, I think the other point to make is how you put it in your portfolio. I'm not putting IHG in my fund as a 5% weighting. It's sort of a 1.5% weighting, and that's often how we manage risk in the portfolio. It's about the business risk, and clearly some of these stocks we're not going to, the biggest stocks in the portfolio are still the globally diversified cash generative defensive players.
Right. Okay, so it's got that kind of strong and robust core to it, but with some more opportunistic purchases around the outside. So
yeah, and that's exactly correct.
Yeah, and are there areas where you look at them now and you just think, well, look, the whole world has changed in an irreparable way, and that these whole sectors or these particular kinds of businesses, they're now uninvestable in this environment?
Look, I've been saying for the last 3 years that, you know, be wary of very, very expensive quality businesses, and definitely be very, very wary of value traps. I always say at the end of, you know, I always sort of say to my clients at the end of a presentation, I mean, this is not post the crisis, but before, which is that, and it remains the case, that we want to own companies that can navigate a world of geopolitical stress, economic uncertainty, and structural change. And, you know, COVID-19 is just an extreme, you know, pressure on all of those. But there are still many companies that were structurally under pressure prior to the crisis. And the crisis may have just accelerated that decline. So, you know, I don't mind, companies like Marks and Spencer, being honest, which is a company that I've persistently, you know, refused to invest in, because I think that their, particularly their clothing business, is structurally pressured. And, you know, post COVID-19, I think, you know, online is going to have accelerated, because we're all getting used to, you know, more and more Amazon deliveries at home and using the internet and maybe working from home more in the future and not traveling out as much. And I would argue, it's interesting, I actually read something that, you know, Tesco is one of my biggest weightings. Tesco, I read this last week, Tesco in the last, through the crisis, has put on in sales, in online sales, the equivalent of 3 Ocados.
Wow. Now,
that is a company that clearly is able to manage structural change. It's been, you know, and you look at the valuation of Ocado, but quietly they've just, you know, they've managed to, you know, put on that much revenue from online, and the average basket size, I think, has gone up from 25 to 35 items, etc., etc. Now, all I'm saying is, I think in food retail, if there's a company that's going to win in online delivery, it's going to be the beast that is Tesco. And whereas you look at Marks and Spencer, going back to that, Marks and Spencer in online food deliveries had to partner up with Ocado. Yeah, so, you know, that's the balance. It's who are the people that can come out of this and actually seize the opportunities. And I think, you know, there are some winners and definitely some losers across the piece.
But not necessarily entire industries, but more kind of business models within industries, because you obviously already cited Next as a company that you do expect to be able to come out the other side in robust shape.
And you look at, you know, all the companies, you know, you look at companies that have survived on stock markets for long periods of time. I mean, they innovate. I mean, I started in the city in 1998. And AB Foods basically was all about producing sugar and food ingredients. And today, AB Foods, the majority of their valuation comes from, you know, a discount clothing retailer in terms of Primark. So, you know, some companies are able to innovate and change over time. And I mean, you know, I started my career at Schroders. I mean, at the time, Schroders was the fund management business was a small part of a large investment bank, which they sold in 2000. And, you know, Schroders today is a global fund management player. You know, 20 years ago, it was a global investment bank, or, you know, trying to become one. So often, you know, all companies have to innovate over time. And that's part of our job, is to work out which ones can do that.
Do you think this, do you think the challenges businesses are facing now means that they have to innovate faster than they had done previously?
Good question. Look, I think some of the basics are coming back. I mean, I can't believe now that, you know, everything I read is, you know, we all want to own companies with strong balance sheets. Well, it was ever thus. You know, the reason why, I mean, I've used two good examples. I mean, AB Foods, the Western family back in the day, and Schroders, the Schroder family. I mean, they've always kept their balance sheets very, very conservative, because they know that through time you get stresses in your business, and debt is what kills equity and kills businesses. So in some respects, some of the old adages still remain. Having said that, you're right, which is, you know, which is why I actually increasingly think management teams play a very, very important part. You know, we don't just allocate capital to a company. We're actually, you know, increasingly, you've got to make sure the right people running that company are allocating capital properly and pushing that company in the right direction. So, you know, yes. I mean, I'll take an example of a company I do own, which hasn't performed that well, is Johnson Matthey. You know, it's an industrial business. Now, but they've been investing in a variety of things, but one of them is batteries. Now, that is an option. They've spent millions of pounds on that area of the business. They're a company that understand how to, you know, manipulate and use special metals and precious metals, and, you know, and how that works in the battery area is interesting. Now, it could be, we could be sitting here in 10 years' time, and you say, you guys say to me, Simon, do you remember we had that call on Johnson Matthey? Isn't it amazing that Johnson Matthey is now the world's largest producer of car batteries? I don't know. I'm just saying it's nice when companies have some optionality within what they do. So Next, I'm sure when, you know, Simon Walton at Next launched his online platform and then started putting competitors, you know, you could buy Ted Baker shirts via the Next platform. And it took me a bit of time to work out why that was a good thing for Next. And here we are. And, you know, Simon Wolfson's going to have probably the largest online clothing platform, certainly in the UK, if not across Europe, within a few years. And he's stayed one step ahead of a trend of an industry that was clearly under pressure in terms of, you know, his original business, which was, you know, clothes retailing via physical stores. Yeah, and, yeah, Marks and Spencer's have singularly failed to do that, going back in a circle again.
One of the things you mentioned there was capital allocation. I think some companies, their ability to allocate capital is constrained by the undertakings that they're making to their to their shareholders. So we've seen a huge number of dividend cuts. And as an investor, you know, what there was a time I remember when it was seen as quite a positive thing to see a company maintaining its dividend. It created some sort of perceived discipline amongst the management team. Do you think that's changed, and that now that dividend has become more of an inhibitor to having a flexible capital allocation policy?
Yeah, I have the voice of Ben Meaden, our income manager, in my head here as you ask me that question, because, you know, Ben has always been very insistent that, you know, again, it was slightly fool's paradise that if you own lots of stocks with 5% dividend yields, that you felt that was a good thing, particularly if the company was not reinvesting in their business, for example, in order to pay that dividend or paying that dividend out of debt. And, you know, he's sort of been proved right. This, you know, the crisis has I think the tide's gone out, and many companies that were over distributing have now been found out. Whereas some of those companies that maybe had smaller initial yields but were growing their dividend through time and were able to reinvest cash flow, which meant they had a bigger business in 5 years, which meant they could pay a bigger dividend, maybe the ones that will be seen to be more attractive. So, I mean, I think you're spot on. Right now, if you're sitting on the board of a company, the capital allocation is all about, have we got enough solvency to see us through a crisis that no one, you know, this crisis isn't going to be solved by central bankers. As I said, it's going to be solved by scientists and ultimately determined by politicians. So initially it's about solvency, and hence why we've seen the large dividend cuts. But I think going forward after that, you know, I think the market will increasingly have to differentiate between companies whose dividend is sustainable and growing. What we're seeing now is what we perceived as a house, and Ben in particular perceived as the realignment of dividends we thought was going to take 5 years, is ultimately companies one by one realised that their dividend became unsustainable, the market did, whereas it's all happening in one go.
The other thing we've seen. Carry on.
They're gone.
Well, sorry, the other thing I was going to say was that we've seen a number of refinancings and through placings. And I wondered, so it's less income specific. I'm sure you've participated in a few maybe, but do you fear the dilution that can come with those placings during this environment?
Well, you certainly are if you're the shareholder. I mean, you've got to be careful. For me, it's great because we're coming from a position of strength. We've had net inflows. We've got stable, strong portfolio that we're able to, I'm able to sell, take small, take the outperformance out of my large stocks to reinvest. So, two, three of the places I've been involved in, normally you wouldn't expect as a non-shareholder to be able to get access to the stock at a discount at low prices, but that's currently happening. So it depends which side of the coin you're on. And of course, if you participate in the placing, you don't dilute yourself ultimately in terms of your weighting of the ownership of the company. But yes, I mean, this is clear, which is that there is going to be significant issuance still to come. I mean, I was on the phone to a banker today who was saying, look, for their most of their best companies, they're saying we're not going to go to the market right now when we don't know what we actually need. If you're a good, strong company with a good, strong shareholder register, don't feel you have to go straight away. Wait and see what the outcome is, because the worst case scenario is you don't do enough early on and you have to go back. The second case scenario is you dilute your shareholders potentially, and then you don't need the money. So because things rebound. So I think there's a bit of caution out there, but there is a huge amount of issuance still to be done, and the government's made it very clear they're not going to be giving any outside loans to come any other financial support outside loans in terms of taking equity positions in businesses unless they've exhausted all avenues in the debt and equity market. So for me, I think there's wonderful opportunities, because this is when you get to take stakes in companies at low prices and at discounts. So for me, it's a real opportunity.
Okay, so one of the other things, I guess, which is quite government dependent, is perhaps the outlook for employment, and that's from both a macro perspective, but also for companies. We've obviously got this job retention scheme, which has got a few more weeks left to run. But do you have any impression about how that's going to end or wound down, or be wound down, and what that might mean for the companies who are currently making use of it in terms of them having to ultimately proceed with quite painful restructurings?
Yeah, I mean, I it's clear the government can't, I think, the news yesterday was something along the lines of over half of the working population is now one way or t'other, all of the working, the ability to work or one way or t'other, are being supported by government either through furloughing or direct unemployment benefits, etc. And so they can't, they literally cannot continue this for too much longer. So yes, I think it will be done by sector. But if you are a sector that is enabled to get back to work, we're going to have a significant recession as it is. They're not going to continue to pay the wages of your staff if you're able to, if the reality is if your industry or your business's revenues are down 20% but you're able to work, then you'll have to make some difficult decisions. So yes, I mean, they are going to have to do that. I mean, just as a longer term point, I think, companies' balance sheets will be somewhat less juiced up, the phrase I think someone said to me. And it wouldn't surprise me if I was government, I'd probably be saying to companies, do you know what, like regulatory capital for banks, you will need to keep 3 months worth of staff pay and probably any supplier balances you owe in the next 3 months as cash on your balance sheet, such that if a crisis happened again, at least for the first 3 months, there is the cash on companies' balance sheets to be used rather than going straight to government. And that I think is the impact down the line, that I just cannot see how government provides this support now and doesn't want to. It can't go back to sort of the opposite, the moral hazard of tails you win and heads government pays out if it goes the other way.
So you think sort of companies would need to carry basically more working capital in order to kind of guard against needing support if you get future shocks?
We'll see. I mean every crisis. Yeah, I mean every crisis I've ever been through. I remember the first one was it was 98, which is everyone forgets. 98 was LTCM blowing up, the hedge fund, Russian bond crisis, Asian crisis, and then within 18 months we were at the peak of the TMT boom. It was madness in terms of within 18 months what happened. And so I'm not saying that if we come out the other side of this, people forget very quickly post the financial crisis, before we knew it, there was all sorts of risky lending going on, and collateralized CDOs were back in fashion, all the rest of it. So, but I just this time round, the bank, look at the banks. The banks, have been under significant pressure and regulatory scrutiny since the financial crisis 10 years on, because of the fact they had to take the government's pound. This time round, I don't believe that Main Street doesn't also have, the government doesn't also, it's just as a small example, Rishi Sunak made it very clear that if you were self-employed contractor, prior to this crisis, you were able to, put in your tax return and pay yourself via dividends. And, there was a lot of undeclared income there. I mean, that's just a fact. And he said, well, look, I'm going to furlough you based off of the last 3 years' accounts, but just so you know, as we come out of this, the system's going to change. So, for example, I think if you are a company that takes on IT contractors after this, you're going to be responsible. I mean, we're almost there already, but you're definitely going to be responsible for paying the tax, everyone who works for your organisation, whether they're a full-time employer or a contractor. And it's not going to be left for the employee to try and dodge the tax on their tax return 6-12 months later. So I think there's going to be quite a few things coming through from this. And ultimately, what does it all mean? It means slightly lower growth, unfortunately.
And OK, well, as we're probably running a bit short of time now. So just to finish off, as you mentioned, you're in a fortunate position of having inflows to worry about investing. So where's the emphasis with new money at the moment? Is it towards that sort of stable core of companies, or is it towards the more opportunistic companies that are on the most attractive valuations at the moment?
Yeah. I mean, it's really, I just see whether it's the portfolio as a whole, and either way I describe it is, I think we're still in the first half of the match. We haven't had our oranges yet at half time, and that first half of the match was, fortunately, we went in a strong position, and we've effectively bought about 10-15% more cyclicality, but we're still 83-85% FTSE 100. We haven't gone down the size scale, but we've added to companies we owned ones where there's a bit more cyclicality, where we think the market maybe was overdone, or it's those ones I mentioned where if we saw, they're not, this is a month ago, valuations are very different. We were buying Fevertree at 10, 11 pounds. It's now 17 pounds. So, things have moved around. I'm not prepared to take the cyclicality further until we sort of get into that second half, where we have a bit more clarity around the science, a bit more clarity around the economics, unless we're presented with opportunities. And I think those opportunities come from two ways. It either comes from the market falling further again, and that is a possibility, or it comes from, as I said, the opportunities we may see from placings as capital is required, both from current existing but new shareholders. And so I'm being patient.
Yeah.
So this is a long game, this one. This is not a 98. It's not even a sort of rebound of 08-09. This is quite a long game, this one. GDP currently for second quarter is going to be 30-40% down in the UK. Yeah, and my final point would be, I just don't see the economics rebounding straight away. We've already talked about banks will have to rebuild balance sheets. The pro-cyclicality of their capital buffers means they can, they can wear down their capital buffers now, but as things do get better, they'll have to reinvest to build their capital buffers back up. Companies, we've talked about that, how they may need to keep more cash on their balance sheets and not be so geared. And finally, consumers, a significant chunk of consumers right now will have to, are probably using savings and have worry about their job outlook, and hence they will be rebuilt. They'll be increasing their savings ratio and rebuilding their own balance sheets. And that's going to take years. So this is a long old game here. So we're still trying to keep the bias of the portfolio to companies that will see us through that. But I'll repeat it, the geopolitical stress, economic uncertainty and structural change. And that is the real focus for us.
Okay, Simon, that's been really helpful as an overview of what you've been doing and what you're thinking within the fund. So thanks very much to you. Really appreciate it. But also thanks to all of our Bruin podcast listeners. We hope that you've enjoyed this podcast with Simon Brazier of 91. And we hope also that you'll join us next time on the next Bruin podcast.